This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Well, I wonder how you feel about having your house eaten. Not by termites, but by cockatoos. A particularly unsalubrious development near me, one that looks like a detention centre made of marzipan, is having its cornices devoured by noisy parrots, and good luck to them. But what should we be doing with wildlife where we live? Birds with germs, line-dancing possums, or hungry rodents? Ian Temby is Wildlife Damage Control Officer with the Department of Natural Resources and Environment in Victoria.
Wildlife is moving into our cities and urban areas. We now have peregrine falcons feeding on feral pigeons in the centre of Melbourne and Sydney, flying fox camps in many towns and cities, ibis, gulls, possums, rainbow lorikeets and many other species thriving in human-dominated urban landscapes. Some species do even better in man-made environments than in their natural habitats. Common brush-tailed possums, for example, occur in some city parks at more than 10 times the density they reach in the bush, and silver gulls, sustained by unlimited food from rubbish tips and other human sources, breed year-round and are now moving onto the roofs of buildings to nest. Before I go further, we need some definitions. What is wildlife? For the purpose of this discussion, I include all vertebrate animals, whether introduced or native to Australia, spiders and insects. And what do we mean by the word humane? The concise Oxford Dictionary definition is benevolent or compassionate. I use the term to mean treating wildlife in a way that does not cause suffering or in a way that causes the least harm. We live in environments rich with a wide variety of wildlife. Even a small suburban backyard may have thousands of insects, spiders and other invertebrates of many kinds, lizards, a possum or two, mice and rats either visiting or resident, and many bird species. Some of the birds may be permanent residents, even nesting in the roof, while most will be occasional or regular visitors attracted by food or en route to other places. Living near wildlife creates the possibility for conflict. If there is conflict, it is important to plan calmly and rationally to resolve it, but the first step is to ask, do I really have a problem? What is a problem with wildlife anyway? This is very much a matter of individual interpretation, influenced by, among other things, a person's tolerance, interest, knowledge, and desire to control their environment. If you believe there is a problem, the next step is to learn more about it. First, you need to be sure of the identity of the culprit. For example, a pest control company in Melbourne that specialises in dealing with possum problems claimed that in about 60% of cases where residents complained of possums making noises in their ceilings, the animals responsible were rats. Solutions for rats may not work for possums, and vice versa. Is the problem a one-off or recurring event, and is it serious enough to warrant taking action? More importantly, is it a problem over which you have some control? The koel, or cooey bird, is a large migratory cuckoo that visits eastern Australia during the spring and summer. It calls loudly and insistently, sometimes all night, driving some people to distraction, but is usually concealed in the tops of large trees and there is no legal or practical means of stopping it calling. In this case, the seemingly intolerable, to some, must be tolerated. Only after the facts about a problem have been collected and evaluated should the need for action, the type of action, and its timing be considered. People often take direct action immediately after discovering what they believe is a problem. Taking action is one of the last steps. Action to resolve conflicts with wildlife does not have to be lethal. Exclusion, repellence, changing human practices and habitat modification are all examples of non-lethal actions. These actions often have a more lasting preventative effect than killing or relocating the animal causing the problem. Another possum example will illustrate this point. I had a call from a Melbourne resident with an ongoing problem with possums in his roof. He claimed to have trapped and relocated around 70 possums over a 10-year period. Clearly the penny had not dropped. There is always another possum to replace the removed one. Most of these possums would have died soon after being relocated, and importantly, he was not solving his problem. He was treating the symptom, possums in the roof, rather than the cause, access into the roof. A simple one-way flap that allows possums to leave the roof and not re-enter may be all that is required. With many species of birds and some mammals, relocation makes little sense. Most bird species are highly mobile, and new individuals will continue to be drawn to an attractive food source. And as I have already illustrated, Relocation of a possum from a house roof will simply make way for another possum to move in. Anybody wishing to capture or control native species of wildlife in any way, other than by exclusion, is likely to need some kind of permit or authorisation from the state or territory wildlife authority, as most wildlife species are protected by law. The definition of protected wildlife usually includes the feathers, fur, skins, eggs, and other parts of that wildlife, so it would usually be illegal to interfere with or destroy the nest of a protected bird species if it contained eggs. Why would somebody wish to remove a nest with eggs? Australian magpies are well known for their aggressive swooping at intruders into their territory during the nesting season. Most magpies target other birds, but some also swoop at humans who may be frightened or even injured during these attacks. One strategy designed to stop the swooping is to remove the nests and eggs, in the belief that the birds will go elsewhere. The opposite is more likely. By interfering with the nest, a human may be perceived as a dangerous predator, and the defensive magpie is likely to increase the aggression of its attacks on people. Worse than this, it is also likely to rebuild its nest, thus extending the period during which it will attack to defend its eggs and nestlings. Many people seek another kind of contact with wildlife, through feeding them. But what to feed them, and how much? How often should they be fed? Or should they be fed at all? There are many questions surrounding this controversial issue, and it is no surprise that some people are confused. On a recent visit to Kangaroo Island, South Australia, I drove past a solidly built sign that said, "Birds fed daily at 5 p.m. at the wharf." An arrow pointed in the direction of the wharf. The sign was at the entrance to a town where all tourists entering the town would see it. Later, when I visited a national park on the island, the first sign that greeted me was, "Keep wildlife wild. Please don't feed the animals." Such mixed messages are common and leave one wondering what is right. People feed an enormous range of Australian wildlife, such as crocodiles, birds of all kinds, turtles, various large lizards, and a number of mammals. Feeding wildlife is a very popular activity that can be observed any warm day in picnic areas, at the beach, and almost anywhere people gather to eat outdoors where there is wildlife. Not so obvious is wildlife feeding on private property. This is a widespread and common practice. A survey of householders in Melbourne reported that 57% of respondents fed wildlife on a regular basis. It seems from another survey of wildlife feeding in southeast Queensland that one of the main motivations is that people enjoy it. Some of these respondents also thought feeding helped the birds in hard times. So, what are the problems with feeding wildlife? Large animals that have lost their fear of people, or that have come to regard people as sources of food, can be dangerous. Tour boat operators began feeding Australian fur seals, which rest on channel markers in Port Phillip Bay. During a fishing trip, four men in an aluminium dinghy visited a channel marker to look at the seals, and a large male jumped into their boat, apparently expecting food. The boat suffered some damage, but fortunately did not capsize and the occupants were unhurt. The outcome could have been tragic. The death of a young boy on Fraser Island after being attacked by a dingo was tragic. This death, and numerous bites from dingoes on Fraser Island, almost certainly result from their deliberate feeding by tourists, in spite of signs prohibiting this. One understandable reaction to these attacks has been to cull dingoes on Fraser Island, yet this population represents possibly the only purebred dingoes in the world. Some tour boat operators on the Adelaide River in the Northern Territory encourage crocodiles to leap out of the water to take fish or other food held out by the operators to thrill the tourists. This seems particularly ill-advised training of a potentially lethal predator when fishermen in smaller boats use the same river. In Victoria, sulphur-crested cockatoos attracted by deliberate feeding frequently cause damage to window frames and other external timber and rooftop water heating systems on neighbours' houses. The damage may cost thousands of dollars to repair. Rats and mice can be attracted by food put out for wildlife. I have had a number of calls from interested possum feeders keen to know the identity of the small, attractive, agile grey possums with the very long tails that have increased dramatically and even come out during the day to be fed. They have all been horrified to learn that they've been feeding a rapidly extending family of black rats. There may be few, if any, benefits for Australian wildlife in being fed. Our mild climate and the mobile nature and other adaptations of many of our species means that they can obtain all the natural food they need and to which they are adapted. Yet people derive a great deal of pleasure from feeding wildlife, and for many, it provides an opportunity to feel close to nature. Most people who feed wildlife would like to do it in a way that minimises harm, while still giving them pleasure. The challenge is how to do this. You should never feed wildlife other than on your own property. Whatever you are feeding, only feed small quantities, no more than 2 or 3 times a week. Provide foods that resemble the natural foods of the wildlife you are feeding. Zoos should be able to give you suggestions about this. Avoid attracting sulphur-crested cockatoos, our common white cockatoos, as they are likely to damage houses. Your neighbours may not share your delight at having 100 rainbow lorikeets visiting daily. Try to see their viewpoint. Clean bird feeders frequently to minimise fecal contamination of food and potential spread of disease between birds. And always wash your hands after handling wildlife or places where wildlife has been feeding. Disease is a common concern when wildlife is present, and indeed, wildlife has the potential to spread a range of diseases. The good news is that most of these zoonotic diseases, or zoonoses, as diseases that can be spread from animals to humans are called, are simply avoided by practicing good hygiene. Always wash your hands after handling any animals. I will refer specifically to only one disease, Australian bat lyssavirus. This is a rabies-like virus potentially fatal for humans and bats. It was first isolated and described in 1996. There appear to be 2 strains of this virus, one in flying foxes and their relatives, and one in the much smaller insect-eating bats that may be our most abundant native mammals. The risk to the public of being infected with Australian bat lyssavirus appears to be extremely low. Rabies virus and other lyssaviruses are usually transmitted to humans via bites or scratches. Many bat carers and researchers have handled thousands of both flying foxes and insectivorous bats and been bitten, urinated on and scratched by these bats on numerous occasions with no recorded ill effects. So far, only 2 human deaths due to Australian bat lyssavirus have been recorded. One resulted from a bite from an insectivorous bat and one from a flying fox. If you do not handle bats, then you should be at no risk from this virus. Rabies itself does not occur in Australia. Having insectivorous bats living in the roof of your house creates no specific health hazard to humans, provided you do not handle the bats. Attitudes towards killing wildlife vary predictably according to the perceived status of the wildlife. It is okay to kill some, but not others. Insects and spiders, for example, are often considered expendable as a group, and unselective killing methods may be employed. Electronic insect killers sold to reduce mosquito problems kill any insects attracted to the light. Such indiscriminate destruction of life would be abhorrent to most people if it were applied to other animal groups. And Paul Horn, in his new book Backyard Insects, tells us that only a tiny percentage of insects are pests. I am not aware of research that demonstrates the effectiveness of these killing machines for reducing mosquito numbers, but disturbingly, the crackle and smell of frying insects outside the back door must reassure many purchasers that their money is well spent. Mosquito researchers use carbon dioxide to trap their prey, as this does attract mosquitoes. Rather than killing wildlife, our real challenge is to develop and apply methods of problem resolution that are proactive, anticipating where problems may occur, and taking action to prevent them from actually happening. If they do happen, then we should aim to resolve them humanely by treating the cause, not the wildlife that in many cases is the symptom. In this way, we may acquire a greater understanding and appreciation of the wildlife that will inevitably remain a feature of our urban environments, and which I believe can greatly enrich our lives.
Certainly can. Ian Temby is Wildlife Damage Control Officer in Victoria. Next week, John Bradshaw goes to church and sees a fossil and muses about intelligent design. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.